It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about why Americans change their names. Have you changed your name? If so, why? What about your ancestors? Did they change their name after coming to America, perhaps? How important is your name to your identity? Would you consider changing it if it meant a better life? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Kirsten Vermeglish is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. Her recent piece for the website The Conversation is Why Are Some Americans Changing Their Names? Kirsten, we've talked about American Jews changing their names in the early 20th century and why they did that. How did we see the trend of name changing change later in that century?
So, yeah, it's interesting to sort of watch the chart I watched throughout the 20th century. And as anti-Semitism declines in the late 20th century, by the 1960s and 70s, the numbers of Jews changing their names goes down. And so does the number of name changers in general. They really sort of decline to really small numbers. And then, really interestingly, I think they really explode in the years after 2001. The population of New York City is really different. And the reasons for changing names are mostly really different. You see many more people of color changing their names, many people who are poor changing their names. The sort of the ways that Jews had changed their names back in the 1930s and 1940s is mostly really different for poor people of color today, you know, in the post-2001 era. Instead of hoping that they'll get new jobs, I think that for poor people of color, their concern is to be able to get things like, jobs and checks cashed and, to ease their help through a federal bureaucracy that since 9/11 has become way more concerned with security documents and way more anxious about, you know, a misspelled letter, a misspelled name, one letter off on a name can mean that you can't get your checks cashed or would mean that, you can't get, your Social Security or you can't get your Medicaid. It's a really different kind of feel to go through the name change petitions now. You can still see people affected by racism, but in really different ways.
Let's take a phone call here. Dan is with us in Drummond. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. Well, the story that I'm told was the way we got our last name was one of the relatives went to vote about 1900 in Ashland, and when they were signing him up, they couldn't spell his last name. His last name was something like Poulet. And so instead of signing that, they put down Foley. And the relative had married a woman who was from Ireland, and since that name is so Irish, she latched onto it as though it had been in the family for generations.
Oh, interesting, Dan. Names being kind of changed by bureaucrats is also part of American history, isn't it, Kirsten?
Well, it's a story that's really frequently told. I've actually not heard a story of a name change at a voting in a voting space. So I think that's a really interesting story. Most historians and genealogists say that name changing probably didn't happen at Ellis Island. So that's the most common sort of bureaucratic story of people changing people's names. And there's certainly there's very little to no evidence that that happened at Ellis Island. But in terms of sort of officials, teachers, for example, being sort of representatives, civil servants who might say something like, oh, that name doesn't work, that name is too hard, you'll do better with an American name. Those kinds of stories, I think historians give more credence to. And so, a voting official I've not ever heard, but that's a really interesting story. And, certainly when bureaucrats have had sort of, controls over lists and things like that, I think, and, can sort of put down people's names, sometimes I don't know the veracity of stories like that, but they certainly do play a huge role in American history and in our understanding of ourselves.
Well, both of my parents had their names botched on birth certificates by people at the hospital who apparently weren't listening. And so that kind of thing can happen. I want to go back to your example of poor people of color actually changing their names and how that's related to security documents. I didn't quite understand the connection there.
So I think what happened after 9/11, and you know, this is sort of me piecing things together. Most of my research was of the earlier era and looking at Jews and looking at sort of anti-Semitism. But when I looked at a more recent era, what I found was really striking that people would say things like, my birth certificate's been wrong since I was a kid. Nobody bothered to fix it. Maybe because somebody botched a name at a hospital, it's not clear. Either a misspelling or just a wrong name altogether. Maybe somebody, was raised by a stepfather and had a wrong name on their birth certificate. So you see lots of people saying, "I need to get a check cashed. I need to get a job. I need to get Medicaid." And this name, they won't let me get it if my birth certificate says something different than all my other documents. So I need to have this name changed. Mm. And I just see that on tons and tons of, I would say like maybe 25% of the documents, which is a pretty large number of the documents, much more so than in the early years. So what I would say is that actually throughout the 20th century, there's been more concern with documents. Even during the earlier part of the 20th century, people to get jobs, birth certificates became more a part of the, process of changing your name. But it's really not until the 2000s that you see people saying, I can't get what I need. I can't get my checks cashed. I can't find a job. I can't get my Medicaid. I can't get I can't get Social Security. My name is, my married name that I've been living with all my life, and now I want to get Social Security checks, and they won't give it to me because I've got my married name and I have no other documentation for that. So my theory is that after 9/11, and I think there are other things in American history as well, concerns about immigration and things that have tightened, they've tightened our understanding of documents, basically, that any misspelling, any misname is a limitation and a prohibition for people. But I think the reason that I think this makes poor people bear a heavier burden. I think that people who are middle class frequently, when they get into college, or if they have, a friendly HR department, those kinds of things get smoothed away. People are able to find some kind of way around those kinds of concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas people who are poor, who don't have those kinds of institutions kind of smoothing things along for them, wind up getting more tripped up. That's the theory that I have, because I see so many people who are poor expressing these problems, and really the only people who are middle class, who appear middle class given their jobs and their addresses in my documents, are frequently middle class women getting married. And
right.
Those are where middle class people show up much more in the roles, concerned about things like, their having their documents match, is when women have gotten married and not changed their names and want to change their names at a later date. But otherwise, I think that the burden of, sort of our greater concern about security, at least in these New York City files, seems to be borne more by people who are poor, who don't have people vouching for them, and who may be more reliant on, government bureaucracy to get what they need.
Let's take another call here. We'll go to Casey in Milwaukee next. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. I had two things. I just saw a funny little story that my neighbor recruiter told me years ago. His last name is now Ping, and he tells the story of when his grandparents came over here. They're Italian. Their last name was possibly Pingarelli or something to that effect. And they changed their name in New York City in order to avoid the racism with the Italian community there. Years later, he moved to California and experienced racism because now his name was Ping, and him and his wife couldn't find housing because they assumed that they were Asian or something. So I thought it was just an interesting story that they couldn't win, coming or going, with changing their name.
Yeah.
Casey, thanks so much for that. Kirsten?
Yeah, no, that's a really fascinating story. I will say I absolutely did find it was, although I found majorities of Jews disproportionate, I absolutely also found Italians, usually as sort of a second or a third highest number every year. There was discrimination against Italians. That family is not alone in having experienced racism and looking to change names to be able to get jobs and be able to find their way through culture. And it's interesting that they chose a name that then could be identified with racism in other places. And you do see that, people changing their names to something that to their ears sounds like it's going to work, but in a different context, it winds up subjecting them either to discrimination against their own group. So, for example, Jews in an earlier year might choose Jewish names that sounded more established, more German, sort of more elegant sounding. But by the 1930s and 1940s, those names still subjected them to anti-Semitism. So it's interesting to have chosen a name that sort of refers to another group that's experiencing racism and then experience racism that way. I mean, that's a really interesting story. I haven't seen that particular story, but it doesn't surprise me at all. I think that's really interesting.
And Casey, thanks so much for that phone call. And Kirsten, we're out of time. What a fascinating discussion. I know we could talk about this for a lot longer, but we're going to have to move on. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Kirsten Vermeglish is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. Her recent piece for the website The Conversation is titled, Why Are Some Americans Changing Their Names? Coming up next, our guest says single-use coffee cups may be the death of us all. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. How many coffee cups have you gone through in your life? Countless single-use coffee cups are thrown away every year because they're not easily recyclable. What's the problem of the ubiquitous single-use coffee cup, and why hasn't shunning them caught on in the same way giving up plastic straws has? Jen A. Miller is a freelance writer and the author of Running, A Love Story. She writes about running and the environment. Jen, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, some people might be thinking, why is this such a big problem? I mean, after all, these cups are made out of paper, right? So make the case that there is a problem that people should be thinking about.
Well, they are made of paper, but they're also lined in plastic, which means that they are not easily recyclable. Also, because they are in contact with human food, technically with human food and human bodies, there's a sanitation issue there. So while we think, oh, it's paper, it's not a big deal, it'll decompose or be recycled, that's actually not the case. So we're really just throwing these coffee cups into landfills.
So what exactly are they made out of?
I believe it's polyurethane. It's not polyurethane, I'm sorry, it's early here, but it's just a thin plastic lining. So it is cardboard on the outside. Now, I should say that's not the case everywhere. There's a lot of places that now use compostable cups, but they're still not able to be recycled because our recycling stream does not have the capacity to deal with that lining in those cardboard cups.
Oh, beyond the fact that these cups aren't actually recyclable, why is recycling not necessarily the answer generally?
Well, it's always better to reuse than to find something that's recyclable. I mean, that's good that we recycle. I'm just about to have the insulation in my attic redone, and it's using recycled jean material. But if we can reuse stuff, it's always better because it just adds less to the waste stream. And it doesn't have to be processed. My favorite reusable coffee cup is Captain America. I think that says some stuff about me. But also, if I use it over and over again, it doesn't need to be dealt with. All I have to do is wash it, and there's no waste involved in that.
Yeah, you know what? A lot of small-town coffee shops around America, people have their cups hanging on the wall. They have their name on them, so they don't have to worry about the disposable cup problem. Let's talk about the scale of this problem. How many of these faux paper coffee cups end up in landfills every year?
So in 2016, 250 billion paper cups were made globally, and that's by a market research firm called iMark, and they expect that number to hit 266 billion by 2022. But that also does include paper cups for cold beverages. So if you run the Twin Cities Marathon or any other marathon, you see those paper cups that people drink water and Gatorade from. Those are counted in that too, but largely it is these hot beverage cups.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've been using paper cups for a long time now. Why are we just noticing this problem now?
Because we're drinking a lot more coffee than we ever did. So that cup that, if you've ever been to New York City, that Greek style cup that you get from corner vendors has been around since the 60s. Kander and Ebb had a song called Coffee in a Cardboard Cup from a show that was off Broadway, I believe, in the 70s. So it's a thing that we're used to, but we're just drinking coffee so much more now. And it's just a thing, like you're out with your coffee cup. If you've ever looked in any advertisement of like a nice fall day, somebody probably has a paper coffee cup in their hand. So it's just part of our society now, and maybe we're not thinking about what a problem it is.
So, but has the composition of these cups changed over time? I mean, didn't they used to use wax? Has it always been plastic in these disposable cups?
It's pretty much been the same concept of a cardboard cup with a lining in it since the 60s.
Okay.
Whether the lining has changed, it still doesn't make it recyclable, if that makes sense.
Got it. Jen Miller is a freelance writer and author of Running, a Love Story. She writes about running and the environment. We're talking about coffee cups and the problem that we have with them. This year, Starbucks, the European Union, and the Walt Disney Company all announced that they would eventually ban plastic straws and reduce some other single-use plastics. Cities around the U.S. are considering similar bans. So my question is, why aren't single-use coffee cups included in any of these bans?
So there's an incentive for brands like Starbucks to have their coffee cups around. So you think of the Starbucks logo, it's pretty iconic, that mermaid, and it's marketing for the company. I read it wasn't included in this story, but a small business vendor was writing pieces on their blog about why you should have paper cups as a branding device. So there's very little incentive for a lot of these companies to get rid of essentially the billboard that you're walking around with. Not the case of plastic straws. I mean, how many places do you know that brand their plastic straws? So some companies like Starbucks do offer a discount if you bring in your own cup, but it hasn't changed since the 1990s, as the price of Starbucks coffee obviously has gone up since then. So there is not as much an incentive for them to make the change to get people to stop carrying their billboard around as there is to do something about plastic straws.
So there is a push by some to create single-use cups that are biodegradable. Tell us more about that.
Yes, there is what some companies are calling the moonshot to create a completely recyclable coffee cup. It's called the Next Gen Coffee Challenge. And Starbucks and McDonald's are two companies that are behind this global consortium. They want it to be not only a fully compostable and recyclable cup, but also address issues on the recycle stream process to create technology that allows municipalities to recycle these cups where they can't right now. So the same is the case with if you get takeout in a compostable box. That box actually isn't recyclable, even though you might think it is. So it's the same sort of thing. Like, how do we make a coffee cup that can stand up to heat and not degrade, as a lot of corn – that's an issue somewhat with corn-based cups right now. How do we create a product that will be completely recyclable and compostable? And yes.
So this might be a unicorn instead of a moonshot.
Yeah, I mean, I think with enough money behind it, and there certainly is a lot of money behind it and a lot of big companies, it could be done, but it's still not the same as reusing a cup over and over again. So it's a good thing, but it's not the perfect solution.
Okay, well, let's talk about what individual consumers can do, because we could certainly use travel coffee mugs and refuse to use single-use coffee cups. But beyond that, what are some potential larger solutions to this problem?
Well, I think it's just, I mean, I'm talking on the radio about this, and I wrote this story, and now I had, you know, it sort of expands from there. I have friends who said, oh, well, I'm not going to buy a coffee unless I have a reusable cup, and just put one in their car or their van. Some of it is pressuring these companies to ask, like, well, what are you going to do? There's a couple companies I profiled in this piece who are offering discounts to their customers. There's a place in Newtown Square, Pennsylvania, that gives you 10% right off the top if you bring in a reusable cup. There's a coffee shop near me in New Jersey where you can purchase their cup, and every time you use it, you get coffee for pretty cheap, like $2 off a cup, which isn't a small amount of money. So it's really on us to pressure these companies to say, well, what are you going to do? Otherwise, you know, I'm not going to come here anymore.
Well, and I guess if it starts hitting them in the pocketbook, they'll certainly notice that. Are local governments getting involved in this effort at all of maybe forcing the issue of single-use coffee cups?
Not that I know about. I mean, obviously there's a push to do this, but it's not reached the frenzy of the plastic straw issue to get that sort of attention from local governments right now.
And what happens if we don't do anything? I guess, is this really going to kill us eventually?
I mean, I don't know if it's going to kill us, but it just seems something that's such an easy thing to do to prevent these 250 million cups from ending up in landfills this year. It's just, I mean, how many conferences have you gone to, or Christmas gifts have you gotten, or company giveaways have you gotten that's a reusable travel mug? I mean, I had so many that I had to donate some to Goodwill. And I use them all the time. It just seems like something that's so easy, such an easy change for people to make, that we could do this and avoid a lot of waste, and you'll most likely save some money along the way.
Are there coffee shops that won't let you bring in your own mug?
Not that I'm aware of. There are some coffee shops that have told me, because I ask every time I go in and I bring my cup, I was like, well, what do you want to do? Just to make sure, like, how do you charge for this, or how much am I going to pay? They just ask that they're clean, because you don't want some sort of gross, grody coffee cup being behind the counter there.
Yeah. Is the damage already done here? I mean, we have tossed a lot of coffee cups. We're talking hundreds of billions of coffee cups.
Well, I think we have sort of the same way. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, you know, throwing Pepsi cans in the trash before recycling was a thing. They're still sitting in landfills. But if we're aware of the problem, we can certainly make a change for the future and just not make this continue over and over again to just make it worse.
So this is a problem that we can manage, but we're really going to have to take some action. How do we, we're talking about this on the radio, as you point out, you've written about it. What else can we do to get some policy changes made here? Because it seems to me like somebody's going to have to take some leadership on this issue.
Well, I think there's a group called Stand Earth that I interviewed for this story that is sort of promoting the next gen cup challenge, just to get the word out about it, which is the recyclable challenge. But also their initiatives are that they are lobbying to make these kinds of products that can't be recyclable sort of not illegal, but pressuring companies to do this. They were part of the group that is supporting what Starbucks and McDonald's is doing, but they're still out there saying, hey, this is good, but the best solution is to just not throw stuff away that has to be dealt with in any way. So learning from an organization like Stand Earth and supporting them is a great way to get involved.
And what about putting pressure on coffee shops and local governments to do more?
I would, every time I go somewhere and it seems like a barista is not, like, they have never had a cup presented to them, which has definitely happened, just talk to them about it and say, hey, you know, if you offer a discount for people like me, then you have to spend a lot less on your coffee cups, and that's just a reduced expense for you.
Bottom line, that's always the way to go. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. Jen Miller is a freelance writer and the author of Running, A Love Story. She writes about running and the environment. Jen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, the problem with plastic. Stay tuned.